mama, mama, look there. The children are playing in the street again. Don't you know what happened down there? A youth of 14 got shot down there. The cocaine guns are jammed downtown. The killing clowns are blood money men. Shooting for Washington bullets again. As every cell in Chile will tell the cries of the tortured men. Remember Allende and the days before, before the army came. Please remember Victor Jara in the Santiago Stadium. Es verdad, those Washington bullets again.
This is Joseph L. Flatley, and you are listening to Failed State Update, coming to you in pre-recorded podcast form from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Just want to remind you that I have a newsletter, also called Failed State Update, that you should check out. Go to lennyflatley.substack.com to subscribe. And if you want to check out my other podcast, The So-Called Prophet from Pittsburgh, about a present-day UFO cult, or you want to check out any of my books, please go to my website. It's lennyflatley.net. Today we have an interview with a foreign correspondent and award-winning journalist, according to his book flap, Vincent Bevins. He's covered Southeast Asia for the Washington Post and previously served as Brazil correspondent for the LA Times, and before that worked for Financial Times in London. His book, The Jakarta Method, should be required reading for any Failed State Update listeners. The United States really became an empire beginning in the 50s under President Eisenhower. What the Jakarta Method does is really highlight the lengths that the United States government would go to reinforcing its rule in the various nations in the Third World. In the case of Indonesia, you know, up to 1 million people were murdered, mostly because they were to the political left. And this bloodbath was overseen by the CIA and the U.S. State Department. I just hope that whoever oversees the next global empire, the next great global empire, has a little more of a conscience than we did during the Cold War.
For whatever reason, and we could come to sort of, we could speculate as to what that reason is, we have no problem seeing crimes committed by communist regimes as part of some international conspiracy, right? Like every time that a Marxist regime does something, it's in the sort of standard discursive response is to lump it into one big category. But we never do that for the exact opposite side of the spectrum, right? So even though to a much larger extent, I think it was true that anti-communism was an international movement, for some reason, we treat each case as isolated and sort of a mistake rather than part of a larger, more effective and efficacious system. So the case of Indonesia, I think, is the most important one. So I'm going to go back just, maybe I'll go back just a little bit to introduce the whole country, because I mean, I didn't even really know much about what it was until I moved there. Indonesia is the former Dutch colonies in Asia. It used to be called the Dutch East Indies. That's an incredibly important part of deep globalization, like the trade routes going back hundreds of years. I mean, that's the Indies, like the spices. So this was a huge part of the deep origins of capitalism in the post-colonial order. So after World War II, when the Japanese retreated from Indonesia, which they had conquered, a president named Sukarno united these islands in a sort of anti-imperial, anti-colonial, left-leaning but very pluralistic national project. And Sukarno's Indonesia was seen by Washington as a relatively tolerable force in the post-colonial world. until the middle of the 1950s. And what happened in the middle of the 1950s is the Indonesian Communist Party is doing better and better at elections in Sukarno's multi-party democracy. And Sukarno starts to become a global leader of what is called, at the time, the Third World Movement, which is a movement to bring together all the countries that used to be colonized and to rise up in a very positive way against the First World, which is the group of white countries that used to colonize them, or at least used to colonize some part of the world, to sort of resist joining the Second World, which is the communist countries aligned with Moscow, and to create this new, entirely different movement, which would change the rules of the global economy, and which would try to put all of these nations in their rightful place on the world stage. So the CIA tries to crush the Indonesian left a couple of times in the 50s and fails both times. In 1955, they start funding a conservative Muslim party, Masyumi, and it doesn't work. The Indonesian Communist Party just keeps winning more and more elections, and we know from declassified files now that the CIA understood that the reason they were winning is because they were the best organizationally and the least corrupt, right? So they weren't tricking people. They were winning hearts and minds, and as that saying goes. And then in 1958, the CIA bombs the country and tries to break it into pieces. This also doesn't work because a pilot is caught. A man named Alan Pope crash lands into the beaches of Ambon, a small Pacific island that he and his CIA buddies had just where he and his CIA buddies had just massacred civilians a few days earlier. And this discredits the entire operation. And so for the beginning of the 1960s, there's this very precarious situation in the leader of the Third World Movement, where Washington is sort of trying to maintain this alliance, but back home, people are very upset about it. It's seen as something that needs to be resolved sooner or later. There's one side of the political spectrum that wants to keep Indonesia on side, that thinks it's better just to be friendly with a post-colonial leader that is outspoken sometimes. And then there's others that think he needs to be crushed and the existence of the Indonesian Communist Party is totally unacceptable. When JFK dies, the second group comes into power. So they send in a new ambassador to Indonesia, who everybody knows is sent there as a coup specialist. He's already done a coup in South Korea. And the political system is very split between the army, which has been explicitly backed by the United States since 1958, and by the Communist Party, which has the masses, right? And so in 1965, what you see is an eruption of a conflict between these two groups, which that CIA and MI6 had been advocating for, or agitating for covertly in ways we still don't really understand. And that eruption is used as a pretext by the US-backed army to quite literally exterminate the largest Communist Party outside of China and the Soviet Union.
You know, still, when you hear Communist Party, you think Soviet-aligned, you think... You know, you have all kinds of dastardly, you know, but you're talking about something that is much more social democrat.
Yeah, and sort of the tragic thing about the Cold War is that that's who usually got killed, right? So in the very early Cold War, the CIA, these upper class Yale guys, they wanted to go after quote unquote communism in the Eastern Bloc, and they just kept failing over and over. They couldn't get in, right? They found that when they would parachute guys into Albania or whatever it was, that there was the secret police and they would get caught. And it's across the Cold War, you can sort of make that broad characterization that the movements that really get crushed, Guatemala, Chile, Indonesia, tend to be unarmed moderate groups, because they don't, you know, when the men with guns come for them, they don't have the means or the ideology that would allow them to defend themselves. So in the case of the Indonesian Communist Party, this is, I mean, totally forgotten now, but it was the Indonesian Communist Party was the first party founded in Asia. It was founded in 1914, before the Bolshevik Revolution. So it was founded as a social democratic party. And in a different universe, you could see them becoming like the European Marxist parties that end up just participating in electoral politics forever. Germany Germany having the most moderate one, the SPD, but, you know, you could also think about the Italian or French communists that, you know, would run small cities in the countryside and very much participate in the quote-unquote bourgeois order. And the PKI's ideology was always to do this. From the very beginning, their flavor of Marxism-Leninism after they did join the Comintern indicated that they should help the national bourgeoisie overthrow imperialism, help to construct capitalism, and then try to do socialism much, much later. This worked so well for the Indonesians that Moscow actually directed Mao to do the same thing. Moscow told Mao, hey, you should collaborate with the nationalist forces and offer it Indonesia as a guide to why this would work. It obviously did not work in China. But this was deep, deep in their DNA. They were not what an English speaker would think when you hear the word communist. They were not scheming at all times to overthrow the country, the government in a violent revolution. They were supporters of the country. They were supporters of the president. If you grew up in certain neighborhoods of Indonesia and you had certain interests, like if you were into art or if you were into education or if you wanted to get into agriculture, it was incredibly likely that you would end up affiliated with the Communist Party. And this did not mean that you went through some sort of indoctrination. That was the union you joined if you worked in this sector. If you were from certain regions with certain religious traditions, everyone was affiliated with the Communist Party. It was absolutely not joining an underground cell of armed revolutionaries that knew that they were risking their lives. It was the exact opposite, which is why, as I said, the mass murder worked. Nobody thought they were bad guys. Everybody thought, oh yeah, like I'm in the teachers' organization. And that allowed them to be decimated, and their decimation led other parties around the world to reconsider their tactics, right? So we've all forgotten about the Indonesian Communist Party, but in 1965, everybody was watching. This was the largest party outside of China in the Soviet Union, and parties from Latin America to Asia looked at this and thought, oh, does this mean we have to be armed or else we're going to get killed? And that is one of two sort of waves that emanate from the massacre that I analyze in the book, and the other being the far-right forces that come to the conclusion of, oh, yeah, we could just do that. We can kill all of our political enemies, deny it, and as long as we're sufficiently anti-communist and pro-Washington, we're going to get away with it. You know, if Suharto, the general that ended up taking over as dictator in Indonesia, if Suharto could kill a million innocent people and you know, nothing happens to him, well, we can certainly do that in Chile and in Brazil and Central America. And that's the sort of what the book is about, is not only the horribleness of this event, but the ways that it reformulated both sides of the political spectrum for the decades that came afterwards.
Could you kind of explain the event and also the United States' role in it?
As I said, the 1958 CIA invasion failed. That invasion was failed on the successful coup in Guatemala in 1954, but it didn't work. Indonesia, for whatever reason, it was too big. The army was too dedicated. It just didn't work. So they shifted tactics entirely. And the new tactics involved bringing thousands of Indonesian military officers to train in Kansas, where they would hopefully become more pro-American and more anti-communist. And it seems to a large extent this worked. Now, so as you go through the early 60s, you have Sukarno, who's making a lot of waves in the region because he sees the task of decolonization as unfinished. He successfully wrests control of West Papua away from the Dutch. And then Great Britain forms Malaysia. And the formation of Malaysia is marked by the kind of imperial machinations that a lot of people might be familiar with in Africa and the Middle East, where they draw lines across national boundaries so as to weaken their enemies, right? So Malaysia is created in a way that is very explicitly meant to weaken the left in Southeast Asia, and Sukarno sees this as a threat to himself. And, you know, this is often characterized as a big mistake that he made, but I mean, people were trying to kill him all the time. The CIA had bombed his country. I mean, you would probably be paranoid too, right? I mean, the CIA had authorized his assassination. He picks a fight with Great Britain. And this, on top of Johnson's turn away from Sukarno, really spell the end of the partnership that he had with the West through the first 20 years of Indonesia's existence. And what we know is that in the years so up to the events of September 30th, 1965, which is the real turning point, in the year up to that eruption of violence, both the CIA and MI6 were agitating behind the scenes through disinformation campaigns and other ways that we still don't know about. These files are still classified. But the goal was to cause a clash between the army and the PKI, the Indonesian Communist Party. And everybody knew that if there was a clash, the PKI would lose because they're a mass-based protest party. They're not ready for a civil war. They're not even ready to run away if the cops come knocking on their door. They're a fully civilian party. And so we don't know the form that this takes. And the book, as you know, is told through the stories of a lot of people that lived through this these events, people that were either somehow involved in the party or very involved in the party, just living in Jakarta at the time. And what they tell me about 1965 is that there was just rumors all over the place. Everybody was talking about the possibility of a right-wing coup, possibility of a CIA invasion, the possibility of this or that plot. It was just, everything was very tense, and a lot of people were very afraid that something was being hatched. Again, we know that CIA and MI6 wanted people to think this, so it may be the case that that's what my interviewees are remembering, or maybe the case that there were plots. We don't really know, and we're not going to know until the CIA tells us, and I imagine they're not going to tell us until no one cares anymore. I called to ask them. They unsurprisingly didn't tell me. And what you have on the late night hours of September 30th is a group that calls itself the September 30th Movement, that is led by lower level army officers in the attempt to kidnap higher level army officers, seven generals. Six generals die. To this day, we don't know why they were killed, if that was really the intent, or who ordered them killed. But in the very brief period where this so-called September 30th movement is an apparent attempt to kidnap these generals, they claim that those generals were planning a right-wing coup and that they were going to stop them. Now, to this day, we have no idea really what the September 30th movement was. We know that it was led by members of the military. We know that it immediately was crushed by General Suharto, a right-wing general who, for some reason, was not targeted by them. We know that he was friends with the leaders of the movement. We don't know what the reason is that he was not targeted. It could have been that he told them it would be fine. It could have been that they thought he wasn't important. It could have been that he was really behind the whole thing. Theories abound as to what really happened. But we know that the clash that MI6 and CIA wanted happened. And we know that as soon as it happened, the U.S. Embassy in Jakarta saw this as their opportunity to finally crush the left. And so when they begin to receive reports, well, first of all, in these early crucial days when Suharto was trying to establish that he's now the leader of the country, even though Sukarno is still the president, he is offered material support by the U.S. government that give him walkie-talkies to spread his message that this was actually a communist coup and that the communists need to be crushed. And he's immediately recognized by the United States government. And he spreads this very insane story, which is almost too good to have been made up at the time. People think that this must have been concocted sort of in advance because it's too perfect. he shuts down all media that the army doesn't control, and he tells the whole country that this was not an uprising of junior officers that thought they were stopping a coup. This was a communist attempt to take over the country. And really what happened is those generals that died were taken, tortured by communist women in a satanic, deviant sexual orgy. They were castrated as part of this communist celebration. And now the whole country has to come together to crush the Communist Party. The vast majority of the Communist Party, and I mean like 99.9% of them, had no idea what had happened in Jakarta, and were just hearing about it the same way everyone else was. They're hearing these news reports. Now, the army starts arrest. Army and police start arresting en masse anyone who's on the left, and people go in often willingly. These are the people that I met. I mean, it varied from region to region, but a lot of people just went in. Okay, I'll come and give an interview. I'm happy to explain what I was doing. I'm not in that organization that you said did that thing. And instead of just being imprisoned, they are taken out at night to be murdered. Now, the United States government, as they start to hear that this is happening, I mean, again, we don't know everything that they know. But we know that they get reports that this is happening. They are encouraged by it and encourage more of it. They make it very clear to Suharto that his recognition on the global stage is contingent upon the further crushing of the Communist Party, as it's clear that the way that they're doing this is mass murder. The CIA Bangkok office authorizes the supply of weapons to the army, but they don't need them. They already are a fully U.S.-backed, U.S.-trained organization. But if they needed it, it was there. And we know from a later testimony given by a State Department employee that they pass lists to the party of people that could be checked off as it were, murdered. And then finally, when this is all done, when the Communist Party is sufficiently crushed so as to allow Suharto to take over. And I think this is an important part that people get confused. It wasn't like an orgy of violence that happened after Suharto took power. The violence allowed him to take power, right? So before the massacre, the Indonesian Communist Party had about 25 to 30% of the country either in the party or somehow affiliated with it. You couldn't just say I'm the president now and have it work. It was only through this war of attrition that they carried out against the Indonesian Communist Party that Suharto was eventually able to take power. And when he did, he was immediately recognized by Washington and Wall Street, and all the company, you know, U.S. companies poured in for fancy conferences and started to exploit Indonesian natural resources. And Suharto became one of the most important allies of the United States in the Cold War, even as 1 million people were still in concentration camps, including a lot of people that I got to know for my book. And the whole thing just dropped off the map for the rest of the 20th century. No one talked about Indonesia again to this day. You know, it's not only like my friends that I went to middle school with that don't really know much about Indonesia. It's like editors at the New York Times or Washington Post. It's people don't know anything about this country. And I don't think it's a coincidence that it's the country where the U.S. participated in probably its worst atrocity of the last 100 years.
So the CIA and the United States, you know, encouraged and enabled this these events. How long was Suharto in power?
Until 1998.
Right, and there's still a continuity between.
There is military continuity, right? So the Indonesian military. There's a direct line from 1965 to now. They're still incredibly powerful. Their interpretation of events is the same as it was in 1965. They still insist upon the propaganda that was used to carry out the mass murder rather than any recognition of the crimes they committed. But since 1998, there's also been a re-democratization. So now there is a president that this president that was elected, he's very much an Obama figure, not only because he like really looks like Obama, and they're very similar in personality. When he was elected, 2013, although it might be 2014, it was thought that maybe he would finally turn the page on this and apologize and start some kind of a reconciliation, a process of national reconciliation or open a truth commission. None of that happened. And it's become pretty clear the reason it didn't happen is because the military is still too powerful to allow it to happen. So in the broadest sense, you're absolutely right. It's the people that did it won, and the people that were the victims are still told they deserved what happened to them.
And when did the Jakarta method begin to be implemented elsewhere on the globe?
So the Jakarta method, right? So the use of the word Jakarta to denote right-wing terror carried out against left-wing civilians starts in the early 70s in Chile and Brazil at the exact same time. But it's also a sort of a that's a narrative strand that works for my book, but it's not the case that this was always called Jakarta, right? So you have, going back to 1954, you have reports that the U.S. ambassador after the coup in Guatemala handed lists to the Guatemalan military telling them who they would kill. In 1963, when the Ba'ath Party takes over in a coup, we also have reports that the CIA gave the party that a young Saddam Hussein was assisting in mass murder lists of communists and leftists that they could destroy. But the apex of this story, the apex of this violence, the emblematic case which became a global reference, was Jakarta, quote-unquote Jakarta, in 1965-66. And we see this exact language being used during the presidency of Salvador Allende. So when Allende is elected in 1970, and again, precisely what worries the CIA when he is elected is that his form of democratic socialism will be successful and might inspire other countries to try it. As he takes office, there is US-backed terror against him within the country, and the Brazilian military, which took over in a 1964 coup, is assisting the Chilean military in preparations for a possible coup. As these two groups are working together, you see the emergence of the Jakarta metaphor on the streets of Santiago and being whispered here in Sao Paulo, where I am now. So in the most terrifying and obvious way, if you were a socialist or worked in the Allende administration, you might have somebody come up to your house and spray paint on the walls, Jakarta is coming, or you might get a postcard in the mail that said the same thing. And by then, the message was pretty clear. It was, we're going to kill you, right? In Brazil, you had Operação Jakarta, which we have reports was a scheme to kill communists in the active in the Brazilian dictatorship. And in both cases, Jakarta came, right? Like it happened, it worked. And just as I said a moment ago, if anybody thought that they could get away with this and that the US would play defense for them, they were right. It's exactly what happened. With the eruption of violence in Chile in 1973, you have the consolidation of the Pinochet regime. In 1975, Brazil, Chile, and a bunch of other South American countries form Operation Condor, which is a international terror network that allows them to kill dissidents even if they leave, even if they cross the border, right? So they're killing tens of thousands of their own people in Argentina, but what happens if a quote-unquote enemy of the people makes it into Uruguay or Bolivia? Well, you know, we have the mechanisms to do that, and the United States provided crucial into technological equipment for this operation. And then finally, this horrible wave of death and violence makes it up to Central America, where the numbers are the worst in the Western Hemisphere. So you get hundreds of thousands of dead in civil wars in the United States backyard in the 80s. And these are often the communities that send their immigrants to the United States now. So it really is, you know, like the way I visualize it is like this kind of this wave that's building across the world in from the 50s to the early 60s. It breaks in Indonesia in 1965, and then it washes over the rest of the quote unquote third world until the end of the Cold War.
I mean, is it just that it's currently not the best strategy for, you know, like, why did it stop, you know, why did it stop happening?
I think it's a good question. I think that even though they were wrong, even though it was inaccurate, and they often knew it was inaccurate, Washington often acted as if the Soviet Union was an existential threat to the quote-unquote American way of life. And I think when they told themselves that this or that country could fall into an enemy camp, that justified a much more violent level of intervention than we've seen in countries of that type since. However, if you were, so when I say of that type, I mean, you know, the U.S. backed a coup in Honduras in 2009, a coup in Venezuela in 2002. Do I think that it would have been, well, Honduras has really, really suffered since that coup. However, I don't think that the United States would let Venezuela, you know, Juan Guaido get away with mass murder if he were to take over Venezuela right now. I'm not sure. Maybe they would. However, the existential threat that took the place of communism from, you know, 2001 to 2020, whatever, you know, radical Islam itself, that justified hundreds of thousands of deaths, right? So the war in Iraq killed hundreds of thousands of people, and that was considered justified. It wasn't rounding them up and taking them out one by one, but, you know, it was very, very brutal. So I think that you see a shift in priorities as to what is acceptable, right? So when communism is enemy number one of the United States, it's acceptable to kill 500,000 to a million people in Indonesia, to kill 2 million innocent civilians in collateral damage in Vietnam. Now, still, you're definitely going to, you know, still Washington has shown itself willing to intervene in Latin America in order to sort of maintain the contours of U.S. hegemony in the Western Hemisphere, or to maintain a favorable business environment for U.S. companies. But it was when world enemy number one became Islam, or a certain version of Muslim extremism, that the same kind of violence was justified there.
Yeah, I mean, it just seems like Washington is going to avail itself of whatever tools it has, whatever army it has. Like, the military, technologically and how it's organized, it, you know, is a lot different than it was 40 years ago. You made a really good point about, you know, if thousands and thousands of people die in a war in the Middle East, as opposed to being round up and shot in Indonesia, it's still, you know, it's still mass slaughter for the U.S.'s gain.
Yeah, and I think it's like, when I explain what happened in Indonesia in 1965, I always tell the story of the three different attempts, right? Because I think for a lot of people, especially U.S. citizens, it would be hard to believe that they would just, like, choose to murder a million people. And they actually didn't, right? Like, they tried other stuff first. And it was only this final solution, which had emerged as a possibility in the moment of crisis, that they got behind it, right? And I think that the toolbox available to the hegemon is larger than it was in the 60s. But even then, the first thing they tried in Indonesia was to just give money to the party that they like. And the second thing they tried was to kind of break up the country with sporadic military operations. And I think, I mean, defenders of the CIA will say, oh, well, now we have, we don't have to always do coups. Now we have the National Endowment for Democracy or USAID, which are able to put pressure in very significant ways without having to resort to that kind of skullduggery. Yeah. And, you know, like, and I think that that's, I think that scans with the way that a lot of even critical U.S. citizens, the way that a lot of U.S. Citizens think about their government is that they wouldn't choose, first of all, to go for the mass extermination program, right? If there are other, things available, they're going to try those first. I mean, Juan Guaido in Venezuela, I think he's a good example. Like, they've tried all these, you know, it's kind of been like escalating stuff, right? Like, first they just declared him the president, and then they tried this very provocative aid convoy that was headed at the border with Colombia. And then they, you know, people on the Colombian side of that convoy lit the convoy on fire. Then Marco Rubio on Twitter blamed it on Maduro and tried to use that to fire up some kind of a attempt at regime change. So, like, you see, that's an, I think this is a pattern which is important to recognize in the history of U.S. covert operations and covert operations in general. There's a incorrect affirmation sometimes that the CIA is all powerful, that they do whatever they want, that they engineer everything. The real superpower that, the CIA has is impunity, right? They're allowed to just keep trying different stuff and they never get in trouble, right? So they can try this, they can try that, they can fail, they can try stupidly, they can try more stupidly, they can try one more time. And if they're eventually able to succeed, then great. And if they fail, then it doesn't matter. There's no consequences. So that is, I think, a really defining characteristic of the era of U.S. hegemony. It's not really that you have to always do what the U.S. wants, but if you only get one chance. If you mess up in opposition to the hegemon, you're probably done for. However, if you are the hegemon or in a, or in alliance with the hegemon, you get to keep going. You get as many tries as you need.
And you're in Brazil right now?
Yeah, no, I'm. I was supposed to be on a book tour right now, but that's all canceled. So I came back to Sao Paulo to do an article about Bolsonaro in February for the New York Review of Books. And then I was going to go to Chile, where they're having a referendum. They were having a referendum to overthrow the Pinochet constitution. And then I was going to go on a book tour, and all that's canceled. So I just stayed here. I'll figure out like how to leave later. But I mean, I just figured it was like the most responsible thing for me to do would be just to stay put and you know, do podcasts from this like abandoned office building in like the very, very dark center of Sao Paulo at the moment. It's like, it's not a good scene.
Being in Central or South America, you must really be, you know, still seeing the remnants of American imperialism firsthand.
Yeah, I mean, Bolsonaro's the president, right? This affects my life every single day, and not for the better. This technology of pretending that there's an international communist conspiracy in order to justify and consolidate power is still very much in use. So a couple weeks ago, Bolsonaro's foreign minister, in the middle of the night, like stayed up all night writing like a very long blog post about a new Slavoj Žižek book that he read. And he used his, I don't know what, caffeine or whatever else driven blog post to affirm that he had discovered in Žižek's book that coronavirus is a communist plot. And so instead of the old Marxist-Leninist formula that there would be socialism then communism, now it's going to be globalism then communism, and coronavirus will be used to sneak in globalism, and if we're not valiant and blah 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 blah, we're going to wake up tomorrow in the gulag. And like, he's the foreign minister, and this is a country that 10 years ago when I first moved here was like a widely respected, modern, forward-thinking diplomatic power. But these dark forces returned in a big way all of a sudden. And like, yeah, it's every day. Like, it's he's the president here. And like, his son recently in Congress put forward a bill to outlaw communism, and his inspiration for that was Indonesia. He wanted to reproduce the legislation that Indonesia has had on its books since October 1965, the immediate aftermath of while the violence was still happening. So it's not, this is another thing I try to drive home for US readers. It's like, imagine if the KGB bombed Pittsburgh in the late 50s and then carried out mass murder in Florida in the 60s. And, you know, we think of it as a long time when it's somewhere else, but it's not a long time. It's not a long time for those of the countries that lived through it. Right. Like, there's this really weird, like, there's this hand waving that comes along with just the phrase Cold War in the English language. They're like, oh yeah, well, that was the Cold War, as if that means it doesn't count or didn't, you know, say, so, yeah, it was the Cold War, as if that allows for its removal from history. It's like, no, it's right here. And everybody knows it's here. And this is the thing. I mean, this is, I told you, being the call, I was finishing this op-ed for the New York Times, who knows if they publish it, but like, that, not only do we not recognize that it matters for everybody else, we don't recognize that everybody else knows about this stuff. And that's very dangerous, I think, if the U.S. goes into this kind of confrontation with China, thinking that the rest of the world views us the way that we view ourselves, right? Like, everybody down here knows what it is. You know, for example, this always annoys sort of liberals and Democrats when I post it on Twitter, but like, at Bolsonaro rallies in Brazil, okay, I'm going to see if you can guess, they wave three flags at their rallies to indicate that they're on the hard right. Brazilian flag in two other countries. Can you guess which countries it is?
I don't know. American flag.
Yep.
Indonesia?
No. It's another I country, though.
Iraq?
Israel.
Yeah.
So like, if you're on the Brazilian far right, the way to indicate that you're part of this global right-wing movement is you wave the American flag, right? Like, everybody in South America, everyone knows that's what it means, right? Every time the American government has had a hand in choosing outright a government in South America, it's always a hard right government. And like, that's not what the New York Times reader thinks America stands for. And I think that contradiction is dangerous, between the reputation we have really and the reputation we think we have.
Yeah. You know, it's, America being the big bully, you know, at the top, you know, doesn't have to take in anything. You know, Americans don't have to learn anything about the world or how America is seen in the world. We're just sitting at the top, reaping the benefits of, you know, this hegemon. And, you know, and I think it's making us in a real practical way weaker as a country, like what you just described. I mean, that explains a lot of, like, I think, like, the craziness that's coming out of Washington and the Pentagon, you know, like, not having a sense of, or, you know, even Project the New American Century or the whole neocon thing. It's based on a vision of the world that exists in a lot of Americans' heads, but doesn't actually exist in the real world, I think.
Yeah. And like, in the book, for the research, I end up meeting this guy named Frank Wisner Jr. And his father was the the original Dr. Evil of American Empire. His father created the CIA's covert operations program and oversaw the most famously awful parts of it. And I met his son, who is now a retired diplomat, works in New York. And even though he defended that his father believed he was doing the right thing, and I think I also believe that he believed he was doing the right thing, but I also believe that Stalin and Hitler thought that too. He was remarkably, what he said is remarkably similar to what you just said. He said, look, the United States, he called it the land of the great amnesiac, and he said that our privilege has given us the apparent ability to forget everything we do and forget how much it matters to other people. And then that's a real problem. So while he, you know, didn't want to say, oh, my father is guilty of atrocities or whatever, he basically said the exact same thing that you did, is that it is irresponsible and untenable the extent to which we forget what we've done to other people like 20 minutes ago. I mean, and in the Indonesia story, this is a huge part of it. So like in the early 60s, Congress could not understand why Sukarno was so suspicious of the United States. And this was like 2 years after the CIA tried to break the country into pieces. Like imagine how long Americans would hate, I don't know, France, if France bombed the United States and tried to break it into pieces. It would be longer than 2 years. It would probably be 1,000 years, right? I mean, and they saw it as this kind of like, in a very racist and condescending way, by the way, and it won't surprise you to hear that it was explicitly racist at times. It was considered like he was this immature child that didn't, you know, he didn't know how, he's biting the hand that feeds him. Doesn't he understand that we want to help him and stuff? Because he was paranoid about a country that tried to bomb and assassinate him just a couple of years previously. So I think it's a time bomb. And I think, I mean, this, it's been very interesting during this pandemic because China has like very quiet, not quietly, but very gradually started to turn its propaganda capabilities on the United States. Like in a very mild way, China has started to really kind of blame the United States for its response or to even spread conspiracy theories that the United States caused it, blah, blah, blah. But I think if they really turned on the big guns, we would be really shocked how much material there is. I think if China really wanted to like say that we are a settler colony, a genocidal settler colony that keeps 2 million people in prison, vastly overrepresents its black population in jails, is currently bombing seven countries. If they went on like Twitter and were just like blasting that stuff out to the world, it would all be correct. And I think we'd be really surprised how much there is. And I think that that is a time bomb is the wrong word, but I think that the it is very tenuous. Our like the extent to which we memory hole things is I don't think it's going to be sustainable in the long. There's going to be some kind of a rude awakening in the long term, I think. And I think that's even kind of like why they let me write this book, you know, like. I'm not the first person to figure this stuff out. I mean, I think I made some new connections across countries and with my particular interviews and with my particular global context. But like the question of U.S. Complicity and guilt in these crimes has pretty much been well known for a very long time. But I think there's maybe something about this world historic moment that allows for a little bit of reflection. Maybe even Trump's presidency allowed for. Okay, well, maybe America is bad. Maybe America is bad. Let's hear that side of the story. You know, let's let somebody make that case. Whereas I don't think you would. I'm not sure that a liberal in New York publishing house would have wanted to do that under Obama. I'm not sure.
Yeah, and it's really just struck me reading this book and then just still hearing about Russiagate, and you know, and it's just so amazing. Like you know. What the U.S. media and what the, you know, people in the government are characterizing Russiagate as this like democracy destroying grand evil genius theme. And it's like,
it's projection.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, this was true in the Cold War too. The CIA told themselves constantly like, well, the Soviet Union must be doing this if we are, but they weren't. You know, there's no way, you know, the Soviet Union absolutely was not like parachuting people into Kansas and trying to like incite rebellions and things. They knew that would be suicide. And I learned just enough Russian I took a couple years of Russian in Sao Paulo because I thought I was going to go live in Russia. And when I ended up going there, the secret police followed me around for a couple days, which put a damper on that plan. But I knew enough people in Russia that when Russiagate happened in early 2017, I was like, well, it's okay. All right. So I found an excuse to go out there and I talked to all my Russian correspondent friends. And I was like, is this real? What's going on? You know, what? And they're like, no, uniquely. And they're like, uniquely, they're like, no, this is... We're getting kind of our marching orders from Washington, and we have to sort of pretend like this story is valid. But we all know that Putin is not that. He is not Dr. Evil, right? Like, he does not have that much power. He's not that well organized. There might have been some kind of like small programs that, you know, while deplorable, of course, like, you don't, it's not cool to run ads on Facebook in another country's election. I think the extent to which it like really dominated liberal media from 2017 to 2019 is indicative of a crisis of confidence in U.S. liberalism, right? Like, because rather than look at like reasons 1 through 10 that Trump was elected, we had to like fall back on this muscle memory from the Cold War of like the evil boxer from Rocky, you know, that is like the most evil person in the world, and blame some foreigner. And like, yeah, like I said, while Vladimir Putin is, you know, sucks and is far from blameless in 2016, it seemed like a really worrying reaction, you know, to instead of try to figure out what it was about him, you know, that led so many Americans to vote for Donald Trump, then just to put the entire thing on this darkly evil foreign entity, which conveniently happened to be the same race as our last darkly evil foreign entity before the Muslims. Yeah, I mean, I'm not, it was, I didn't find it encouraging.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, and, you know, the way that in the United States, the COVID-19 issue has been so politicized, it's, you know, it's like wearing masks is now is a code word for being a liberal, you know, both sides, you know, people, you know, the liberal Twitter loves mask shaming. And then like, I have friends that like work out in like rural areas that, you know, people see them wearing a mask and they give them hell. And even like the open up protests, the reopen the economy protests are just obviously like AstroTurf.
Yeah. Right, it's very, it's like, I mean, I am not a defender of the Chinese Communist Party. I want to make that clear before I make this next point. But when I lived in Asia for just a couple of years, what's striking out there is like, oh no, some people just like aren't Democrats. They like don't believe democracy is good, right? They're like, no, it's a waste of resources. You end up fighting with yourself the whole time, and it's better just if everyone gets behind, you know, one thing or whatever. And while obviously as an American, it's like I'm constitutionally really incapable of agreeing with that, all of those people, when they look at what's happening in the U.S. right now, they can point to evidence for their side, right? It's like, for what reason would you ever have a partisan debate as to whether or not chloroquine, or I don't know how you pronounce it in English, in Brazil it's chloroquina, but like it's the similar, like you have a partisan line as to what extent there should be a lockdown. And like both sides agree that there should be some amount of measures, right? But then there's a line that divides the country into two big hostile camps. And like, what kind of a political system transforms banal, not banal, but like entirely apolitical questions like, you know, what medicine works into partisan battles, right? And if you're one of the guys in the Chinese Communist Party that's been saying for 30 years, like, don't do democracy, it's going to fuck up. Like, you're going to get a buffoon in charge and you're going to waste all your time fighting with each other. The attitudes and the activities on display in the United States in the last 10 years, man, like, you put that in your, you know, throw that in your PowerPoint presentation, because, like, it's convincing. And I don't like that. But I mean, you have to recognize, like, what do you like? Why would there? I mean, Brazil has the same thing, by the way. We were ahead of the curve on this. So Bolsonaro was participating in anti-lockdown protests before they even really took off in the U.S. And there's a back and forth between the two political movements. But it's like, but again, here the partisan debate is so like here, if you believe that chloroquine or chloroquine, I don't know how you pronounce it. Do you know how you pronounce it? How do you pronounce it in English?
Hydrochloroquine, I guess.
Sure. Yeah, in Brazil, if you believe that chloroquine is good for you, then you're on the right. And if you believe it's bad, then you're on the left. Like, it's, that's, you know, it's, it is, I don't think it's a small problem. Mm-hmm. I think that is indicative of a real crisis in the ideological structures of the type of globalization that we got as a result of the Cold War. And that's what this book is all ultimately about, right? So it tells the story of the massacre and the way that the massacre had consequences elsewhere. But it's really a story about the nature of US-led globalization. And I wish that story wasn't so important right now, but I think we are at a moment where it's like, oh no. It is important to step back and be like, okay, what is this order? What is this system we created since 1945, led by U.S. violence and sometimes the lots of stick, sometimes carrot. What is that thing that we built, and is that really what we need to desperately try to claw back from rising Asia? Like, well, let's think about it for a little bit.
Thank you for listening to the latest episode of the Failed State Update. I'm your host, Joseph L. Flatley. You can follow me on Twitter at Lenny Flatley. Or if you're interested in my books, my newsletter, my stories that I've written, all my journalistic endeavors, check me out on my website, LennyFlatley.net.